Today is the festival of Nagarjuna, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about something he wrote. Now, I myself have never up to now really read Nagarjuna's work because I've always thought of him as a great abstruse philosopher way beyond me, writing about shunyata, and I thought this is, you know, beyond my ken. But then Reverend Master Khotin pointed out this little thing he wrote about bodhicitta. Nagarjuna was a monk of one of the founders of the Mahayana tradition, lived around the second century of the Christian era, and he wrote a lot of things. He wrote a great discourse on the middle way, lots of really beautiful, analytical, being Indian, and deep, really profound spiritual works. But it wasn't just intellectual. He didn't do it from the point of just from dialectics and just to kind of explain things. He did it to help people. And he did it to help that other people with an intellectual bent could read his works, and he would explode all the intellectual concepts. Now, as I said, I haven't read most of these things. But this is what he would do. He would kind of bring you through this whole thing and then kind of blow it up in your face, in order to lead people to see beyond the concepts and the ideas, which help, but you don't want to get stuck with them. So this is what he did. This is his way of showing that which lies beyond the thinking mind. And his works are full of sound, straightforward, good advice. Reading, you know, bits of them as I've been the last few days, I've been really impressed by how much of it is just actually down-to-earth stuff. It's wonderful. And filled with compassion. And just looking at his litany that we sang this morning, just how much kindness to beings there is in that. I want to help beings. May beings be blessed, you know, have a happy, good life, find the Dharma and so forth. And his exposition of bodhicitta. There's a little section in The World of the Buddha, which is a really nice translation of it. So I'm going to read this little bit and go through it a little for you. Bodhicitta means the mind that seeks the way, the will to enlightenment, that which brings us to training. And that's the bodhicitta that has brought us all here. And to awaken this is of the greatest importance. And on the bodhisattva path, this is one of the first things we do, is to awaken the mind that seeks the way. Otherwise, we're not going to train. So it helps us to start. So he says, thus, the essential nature of all bodhisattvas is a great loving heart, mahakaruna citta, and all sentient beings constitute the object of its love. So this great philosopher says quite simply, the great characteristic of bodhisattvas is this great loving heart. Well, and all of us can think, yes, you know, yes, this means something to me. And I was just so impressed when I read this. It was the first sentence of this little section. And I just thought, how wonderful that this great philosopher, this is what he says, you know. Because we're bodhisattvas too. These bodhisattvas, he's talking about the great, you know, bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, Kishtigarbha, and all those. And it means us. It's not just these great beings somewhere else. It means us, because we also are bodhisattvas in training. So all that he says about the bodhisattvas apply to great beings, and they also apply to us, because we can all do this. We can all open up the great and loving heart and help sentient beings. And what is this great loving heart? Well, actually, it also can be quite down to earth. You might see a little ant drowning in a pool of water, and you don't think, oh, how I love this little ant. Oh, I'm going to rescue this little ant out of my great altruistic loving heart. No, we get a teaspoon or a bit of paper and we dig it out of there. And then we go on our way. We don't do a whole song and dance about it. This is the great loving heart. This is exactly it. Just doing what needs to be done. Oh, being to be rescued, we rescue the little being. And may be blessed, go on our way. We don't have to be thinking it's something special and it's outside ourselves. Reverend Master Jiyu, she had the great loving heart. And she would rescue beings in just this way, in a sense. She would tirelessly talk to people, help people, spend time with people, endlessly giving of herself out of this great, boundless, loving heart. And it's exactly the same loving heart as this us rescuing this little ant, just doing what needs to be done. Ah, being needing help, we help the being. Not thinking about, I can't do it now, or the thought may cross our mind, but just this needs to be done, we do it. And it's not a big thing. We also have exactly the same great loving heart as she did, as the great bodhisattvas do. We also have it. And we show it in simple, small ways and in big ways also. We all have this great and loving heart. It's not a mushy emotional thing. We just do what needs to be done. Even helping beings we don't particularly like, you see some little bug you really don't much care for, a spider that you don't care for, but you don't say, ooh, I don't like spiders. You overcome this, we try, and rescue them anyway. Maybe you get a little box or something, you don't have to handle it and have it run up your sleeve, but we help them anyway. Just doing what needs to be done, not because we like the thing or because we are attached to it, but this is what needs to be done. It's beyond the like and dislike, beyond attachment, beyond emotionalism. And so it's not our own personal, my own private little loving heart. It's great compassion which comes through us because it's not our own. It just flows through us. And this is what Nagarjuna is pointing to. The heart of compassion, the heart of Avalokiteshvara. We have this great heart. We just need to exercise it. When we are patient with somebody, when we're not acting out of selfishness, when we're not just kind of pushing forward our own opinion about something, when we're just kind to someone, we manifest this great heart in exactly the same way. And we help ourselves as well. Therefore, all the bodhisattvas do not cling to the blissful taste that is produced by the diverse modes of mental tranquilization, i.e. meditation. They don't cling to the blissful taste of meditation. They don't covet the fruit of their own meritorious deeds, which may heighten their own happiness. They just let these fruits of training come and go. They don't train just for their own benefit, but for all beings. It doesn't mean it's joyless for the bodhisattvas or for us. The joy comes, we let it go, it comes, it goes, it comes, it goes. We don't cling on to it. We just train because of what needs to be done. It's not just because we get something. We just do it. Let it flow through us. As we give, we receive. It kind of comes in as we give it out. Their spiritual state is higher than that of the Shravakas, for they do not leave all sentient beings behind them. They practice altruism. They seek the fruit of Buddha knowledge instead of Shravaka knowledge. Shravakas means hearers, those who hear the Dharma. And this kind of implies that it means those who aren't out to help beings, but just learning, doing their training for their own benefit. Actually, I don't know anybody who does this. I think everybody, when they start to train, does it for the benefit of all beings when it comes down to it, because it kind of seeps in somehow, insidiously, and we start giving out loving kindness to other beings without even being aware of it sometimes, just letting it come, letting it flow through. And I don't think anybody actually trains just in a little box by themselves. It doesn't work. We're all connected. We all help each other. And we may not even be aware we're doing it. With a great loving heart, they look upon the sufferings of all beings who are diversely tortured in the Avicii hell in consequence of their sins. Now, sins isn't a word that I particularly care for. Mistakes, or unskillful actions, as the Theravadins would call it, things that create suffering, because sins kind of implies some judgment of awfulness. But really, the only thing that happens is that there's a miserable consequence. It's not because we're bad when you make a mistake. It's because we're doing something dumb, and suffering results. But that judgment is not there. So sins, although it's translated that way in this text, I would prefer to call it mistakes. The sufferings of all beings who are tortured in hells because of their mistakes. Now these hells, of course, are not endless. Although they say, he says, a hell whose limits are infinite and where an endless round of misery is made possible on account of all sorts of karma created by sentient creatures. Nagarjuna likes to go on about the hells and all the different kinds of hells you get for the different kinds of mistakes. And I think it's to encourage us not to make these mistakes, not as a kind of a threat, or you will be damned, and you know, but just, this is not wise, because you can end up in this miserable place. Not forever, but for a while. The bodhisattvas, filled with pity and love, desire to suffer themselves for the sake of those miserable beings. Avalokiteshvara is found in all the worlds, as we see out in the little Avalokiteshvara garden out there. There are little statues of Avalokiteshvara in all the hells, all the worlds of the hungry ghosts, animals, and so forth. Compassion is found in all these places. In all these places, beings can look up, even in the midst of these miserable states. Beings can find compassion, turn it around, and end that suffering. It's not limitless, not endless. We can always stop tormenting ourselves. Really, most of our torment is self-caused. There's the consequence, and also what we do to ourselves. Oh dear, I did this dreadful thing. Oh no, I've done the dreadful thing. I've done this dreadful thing. I can never forget the fact that I've done the dreadful thing. And on and on and on. And if we can just say, I've done the dreadful thing. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm sorry for my mistake. I'll take the consequence, and I will stop doing the dreadful thing. Go on. That helps immeasurably. And we may suffer the consequences, but it's not as bad as if we keep on heaping coals on our own heads and saying, oh, how dreadful, how awful this is. That's a kind of a human tendency, but in training, we're trying to stop doing that. So Akansiyan, Avalokiteshvara, compassion is found in all situations, all hells, all miserable states, whatever they may be that we create for ourselves. Kishtigarbha, his great vow, is to remain in hell until all beings are released. He's depicted in his robe with his staff, standing quietly at the bottom of the darkest hell till all beings are released. Again, kindness and compassion, complete acceptance of suffering, of sitting still with suffering beings, sitting still with our own suffering and with the suffering of others, not being frightened by it or pushing it away, not wanting to look at it, but being quite willing to accept it. Just sit still right in the middle of it and seeing clearly, what is it that's going on? Why am I in this situation? Why is this being in this situation, whether it's ourselves or other beings? This acceptance and clear-eyed looking is itself compassion, and that is the way to help to end this suffering, because when we start to look, then we can begin to deal with it, just by sitting still in the middle of it. So there's Kishtigarbha standing quietly at the bottom of hell with us, even in our darkest moment. Compassion and kindness are there, and all acceptance, the acceptance of the eternal, because the unborn never turns away from us, no matter what we may do. It's always right there. So we have the heart of the Bodhisattva, And we are sometimes miserable beings because we are both. We have our own great heart to help ourselves, to help other beings, to help with our own misery, to help with the miseries of others. And seeing that there is more than just this present suffering. Because he goes on to say, but the bodhisattvas are well acquainted with the truth that all those diverse sufferings causing diverse states of misery are in one sense apparitional and unreal, while in another sense they are not so. Now this doesn't mean that the bodhisattvas say, oh, misery is unreal, just buck up and get on, get a grip. No. It's accepting misery and suffering because misery is miserable. Suffering is suffering. Pain is pain. And accepting that with a compassionate heart, but also seeing that there is more than this suffering. And this is the thing. It's not just this present misery. There is something beyond it. There is faith that sees that everything is changing. Misery does not last forever. No matter what we may have done or no matter what state we may be in, it can come to an end. And that within all these situations, there is the unborn, undying, eternal. It's not separate. This very suffering is the very thing that can turn us towards the unborn. And compassion is therefore right within it. And to see this, to see that there is an unreal aspect, in a sense, to the suffering, because sometimes you feel, you know, really miserable, everything is terrible, and just like deep despair, and all of a sudden, it can be just gone. Maybe temporarily, but all of a sudden, it's just not there for some reason or other. It has a kind of empty nature. And although the suffering is deep and great, it also has an aspect of insubstantiality. And I think this is what he's pointing to, that when there is suffering, whether our own or someone else's, or that of another being, if we can sit still in the middle of it, knowing that within this very suffering, there is the eternal Buddha nature. There is something that is beyond the suffering. There is a reason for the suffering. It's not just blind fate. But there is something within it that is compassionate, that can help us and help other beings. The unborn and unchanging lies within it all. This really helps because we and other beings can see that this immediate situation is not all there is. There is always illness, there's always poverty, there's always misery, disease, and so forth. And there is also the unborn, the undying within all these things. And if we just see the appearance, we get swept away by that and we forget that there is this undying nature underneath, within, and through all these things, or the surface of life. Holding out our faith to ourselves and other beings that there is more than this suffering. Nagarjuna says there are two kinds of truth, absolute truth and relative truth. Now, I don't want to get into this too much because this isn't really quite my bailiwick. But this is what I understand by this. Absolute truth exists, i.e. there is the unborn, undying, eternal. Yes. And there's also the relative truth of the appearance of things. This is why we don't discount the suffering and say, oh, it's unreal, there's only the eternal, unborn, undying. Don't worry about all suffering, it's not real, just, you know, get on. Or saying, there's only the appearance of things, there's nothing more, there's just this misery, pain, suffering of existence, all this kind of thing. Or just the things that we cling on to. There's both. There's all is one and all is different. there is the absolute, eternal, unchanging, and there is daily life. Daily life does continue. We still have to make breakfast and do all these things. We can't just sort of sit there saying, oh, none of this exists, and just lie there, you know. We have to live within it. And within that very daily life that is the eternal, it is one thing. They know also that those who have an insight into the emptiness of all existences thoroughly understand why these rewards of karma are brought forth in such and such ways, through ignorance and infatuation, why there is suffering, why we are miserable, why we are in the state we're in, to see that there is a reason for all this, and that the source of it is compassionate. It's not just senseless kind of thing, senseless suffering. Seeing and knowing how we create suffering for ourselves and for other beings, so that we can stop doing that. This is wisdom and compassion working together. If we just have compassion, then we're kind of drowning in the appearance. Oh, this is terrible, this is terrible. There's all the misery of the world. There's all my misery. There's all your misery. And we can't do anything because it's so awful. And just wisdom, you know, oh, there is the undying, there is the eternal, and all this stuff doesn't matter. Don't worry about being miserable. Everything is fine. They work together. Therefore, all bodhisattvas, including us, in order to emancipate sentient beings, including ourselves, from misery, are inspired with great spiritual energy and mingle themselves in the filth of birth and death. Though thus they make themselves subject to the laws of birth and death, their hearts are free from mistakes and attachments. They are like unto those immaculate, undefiled lotus flowers which grow out of mire, yet are not contaminated by it. Just like we live in the world as if in the sky, just as the lotus blossom is not wetted by the water that surrounds it. Within this very mud of life, we do our training, we grow, we find the unborn. They are exactly together. We don't pull ourselves out of the mud and live in the sky, because we will die without our roots. This is the great bodhisattvas, and it's also us. We can aspire to this as well. To help beings, to help ourselves, to help others from misery. Inspired with great spiritual energy, doing our training, the willingness to meditate and go on and continue. And the more we do our meditation and training, the more we want to do it. It kind of continues on itself. And first we start to train, as Ramasji used to say, we start for ourselves. Then we continue in order to help other beings. And finally we just train for the sake of training. We don't go beyond this, oh, I must help all beings, I must help myself. It's just, we just do it. And beings are helped. It's like the rescuing of the ant. We just rescue the ant. We just help ourselves. We just do our training and our meditation. We're not doing it for something. We just do it. We just meditate. We just train. Keep the precepts. Sit still. Do the best we can in all situations. Subject to the laws of birth and death, we are not outside birth and death. We are within this very existence, this very life. And we don't say, well, I'll train when things are better, when I feel better, when I'm not so tired, when I have more time, when things are sorted, when the children are grown, when I have a better job, all this kind of stuff, when I'm old, you know, then I have peace and quiet and I can train. Well, we better just start now, because this is all we have. The past is gone, the future isn't here, and all we have is this very moment, this very breath. So all we can do actually is to meditate, keep the precepts, do our training right now. And this is exactly what Nagarjuna is talking about. Samsara and Nirvana are one thing. One is within the other. We're not living in samsara so we can find nirvana somewhere else. We're not living in the actual mundane world so that we can find heaven somewhere else, or the pure land, or a better meditation state or something. This is what we have right now, this very moment. And these very difficulties, limitations, not feeling well, having too much to do, not always getting along with people, having all our own impatience and grief, all these things that we deal with, within these very situations, these can help us. They help us find our way. They help us to know that true, unchanging nature. Because without our own, this very situation, we would never find it. This is exactly what brings us to it. It's exactly the way we find it. Just by dealing with these mundane things of daily life. Their great hearts of sympathy, which constitute the essence of their being, never leave suffering creatures behind in their journey towards enlightenment. Their spiritual insight is in the emptiness, shunyata, of things. But their work of salvation is never outside the world of sins and sufferings, mistakes and sufferings. And this is us too. Our work is right here in this very world. Within this very life, with the very people we live with, train with, the very things we deal with, within this very body and mind, we find the way. When Nagarjuna wrote his great discourse on the middle way, which is his great big work, whose name I forget, he does his whole reasoning, explanations, exposing all these myths and concepts and so forth. And his conclusion is, nirvana is not emptiness and nothingness, shunyata, which means emptiness, isn't kind of a negative, empty emptiness. Samsara and nirvana are one thing. This very emptiness or nirvana is this very world, is samsara. They are the same thing. This, our worldly life, is an activity of nirvana itself. Not the slightest distinction exists between them. Not the slightest. It's the very same thing. This is the gassho, right and left, the unborn, the seeming, nirvana and samsara, all within this very act right here. This is one reason we make this gassho, just to remind us that within the ideal is the actual, within our very life of birth and death, is the eternal, unborn, unchanging. Whether we see it or not, whether we know it or not, it's right here. And all we need to do is to have faith in this fact, to do our training in order to realize it for ourselves, to take this very breath in stillness and do our very, very best in all that we can do. And that's Nagarjuna's teaching for us for today. Thank you.